Anyways, so Nehemiah chapter 5. It's been a hot second since we've been going through Nehemiah. We had the Youth Sunday last time we met. So who can remind me, what is the book of Nehemiah about? What is it? Oh. So does anyone remember where in history we are in the book of Nehemiah? Like, what roughly is happening? Yes.
They're coming back from exile.
That's right. The Jews are on their way back from Babylon and the Medes and the Persians, and they're rebuilding Jerusalem. So who is Nehemiah? Do you guys remember? Who is Nehemiah? What did he do? He was the cupbearer. Nehemiah was the cupbearer of the king. And where is Nehemiah now in our story? Is he still in Media Persia or whatever it's called? Still in, you know, is he still out in Babylon area, or where is he now? He's in Jerusalem. That's right. So Nehemiah has been made the governor of Jerusalem, and he is building the wall, and he's facing opposition from outside, from all of the other officials in the area trying to stop him. But now we're going to stop looking at all the things around Nehemiah, and we're going to look at like what's happening in, like, within the people that Nehemiah is leading. So before I continue, do you guys know what a litmus test is? So have you ever heard of a pH strip? If you've ever done chemistry, do you guys know what that is? Okay, yeah. So a pH strip is another way to talk about a litmus test. And essentially, it's like a thin strip of paper that you put it into a solution, and it changes color, and it tells you how acidic or basic that solution is. So it's testing, and it's telling you, hey, what is this liquid like? Because there are some acids that are clear, just like water, and then there's some things that are really not acidic that are clear like water. So let me ask you, if you have a litmus test and you put it into a solution, is the litmus test changing the solution?
No.
So is it, you know, it's not making any change in the water. The water's not now different because you tested it. So is the litmus test revealing, like, is it changing the solution, or is it revealing what the solution already was? It's revealing what the solution already was. And have you guys ever heard the saying that power corrupts? That's actually not true. So that's a very common saying out there. Power does not corrupt. Power is a litmus test. Power tells you what was already in the heart of the person that goes. Like, there's another saying that I heard, which if you're into books, you might know where I'm getting this from. But let's say that you have 5 spears. All of them are built and they're sent off to a war zone. And 4 of the 5 spears break. Did the battlefield forge the last spear? Was it the battlefield that created that spear? No.
Let's look at that.
The battlefield just identified the spear that would not break.
What book is that?
It's from one of Brandon Sanderson's books. It's from the Storyline Archives.
I haven't read that one.
But it's a very similar idea. Like, people kind of look at these situations, and sometimes you go through difficulties in your life and really hard circumstances like a battlefield, and they test you. And they reveal what's already there. But then you also have situations where you can get something that you really want. Like, how many of you guys know people that would want to be the president? That they talk about what they want to be when they grow up, and they're like, I'm going to be the president of the United States. Like, I feel like when I was in elementary school, that was a really common thing. People wanted to be the president. And that's actually the president is an extraordinarily challenging position to be in, because, first of all, there's a lot of things you're responsible for. But also, it tests you. It shows you what's already there. Like, there are people who they go around, and in their heart of hearts, they're just trying to get everything that they can for themselves. They only care about themselves, but they're never put into a position where they have control over other people. And it seems like they're swell people. They seem, you know, fine. But then as soon as they have power over 3 people or 30 people, all of a sudden they turn into a dictator, because the same way that they were motivated poorly to begin with, now they just have more people to exert that on. So we're going to talk about, how does Nehemiah handle leadership? Because it's not just about leadership, it's about, what do you do when you have influence over someone else? When you can turn someone else's suffering into your profit, what do you do? Because that's not always when you're a governor. That might be when you have more money than someone else. That might be when you're doing ministry at a church and a decision falls to you. That might be when you're in your family and you're raising kids. How do you exert your influence over your kids' lives? How do you exert your influence over your spouse's life? Like, everywhere you go, whether it's school or other words, Like, let's say you're the captain of the football team. Let's say that you're the head of a group project in your class. Like, when you have influence over someone else, what do you do with it? So we're going to read Nehemiah. So I'm going to start in Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 1. And it says, "Now there arose a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers. For there were those who said, 'With our sons and daughters we are many, so let us eat grain, that we may eat and keep alive.' There were also those who said, 'We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses to get grain because of the famine.' And there were those who said, 'We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields, our vineyards. Now our flesh is as the flesh of our brothers, our children are as their children, yet we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but it is not in our power to help it, for other men have our fields and vineyards.'" So the first point that we see the oppression from the rich. The oppression from the rich. And if we look at this again, you'll notice that there's a famine, and you see that in verse 3. And a famine is essentially a situation where, for one reason or another, food isn't growing. It might be because there's no rain. It could be for other reasons. But the point is that there's no food. And in our modern day, we really don't experience, you know, famine. We, even when we had a drought in California that lasted for years, we just imported water from other places, we imported food from other places, and while it was hot and a lot of our plants died, like, none of us were physically in danger because of that. And the only industrialized country that still has famines is North Korea. But for the most part, in modern day first world countries, we don't experience that problem. So in our stage of life, we don't experience that kind of difficulty, and so it's hard for us to look at them and be like, wow, what are they going through? But also, was there any word that you guys heard in that made you feel uncomfortable? Read over those verses again. See if there's a word that catches your eye. Specifically, read verse 5.
They're going into slavery?
There it is. They're going into slavery. So, since it's in the verses, I need to bring it up. But Nehemiah talks about slavery. And the Bible as a whole talks about slavery. There was a system of slavery in the Old Testament. In fact, there's a system of slavery in almost all of human history. And when you guys hear slavery, what pops into your head? Yep.
The Civil War.
Civil War, yeah. We think about American race-based plantation slavery. But the issue that people run into is that they look at the Bible and they say, the Bible talks about slavery, that's so evil, because the only slavery that we think about is the 1800s slavery. And we think that that's what the Bible is talking about, and it's not. The system of slavery in the Old Testament and in the rest of the world is far more diverse than just American race-based slavery. For example, did you know that Israelite-style slavery is still in practice in the United States today? I see some wide eyes. So, military. The style of slavery that happened in Israel, that is legislated in the Old Testament, is extraordinarily similar to enlisting in the military in the United States, where you sign a contract, and then for a set number of years, the military basically owns you. Like, I've heard of people that they did something stupid and break their leg, and then they get fined for damaging government property. And when you're in the military, if you're on a battlefield and you disobey a direct order, a lot of times, or at least historically, they could shoot you. Like, they had control over your life. They have control over where you go, what you do. During the time that you're in the military, the government owns you. And that is essentially how slavery in the Old Testament worked. Exodus 21 verse 2 says, "When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go free for nothing." So in Israel, there was a set period of time that you could be a slave. And there were like other things as well, but we need to understand that when it talks about slavery, it's not talking about 1800s race-based plantation American slavery. Not the same thing. So instead, what we should be looking at is that they are desperate. There's a famine going on. They can't tend their fields, and they're having to sell off what they have. They're having to sell their property. They're having to borrow money. And when you start selling yourself and your family into slavery, that's a sign of desperation. In America today, we have welfare. We have systems and things in place. We have private charities that you can go to when you're on your hard on your luck and you can get taken care of. They didn't have that. For them, when they were in a situation where they had no food, they either were going to die or they could sell themselves to someone, and then that person would provide them a place to live, provide them food, provide them pay, and then they'd go free afterward. So these people are desperate. And the reason that they're desperate is you see that they're borrowing money in verse 1, it says, "Now there arose a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers." So who are they borrowing money from? Who's taking their fields? Who's taking their vineyards? Who are they selling themselves into slavery to?
The Jewish.
The Jews are selling themselves into slavery, are borrowing money, or having to give their things away to other Jews. And so the thing that you think about is that this is actually a breach of the Old Testament law. In Deuteronomy 23, verse 19, it says, "You shall not charge interest on loans to your brother, interest on money, interest on food, interest on anything that is lent for interest." And the issue is that these people are in a situation where they are desperate. They are hungry. They are facing the possibility of death. And the rich people in this situation, the rich Jews, are looking at all these really hungry people who own fields, who own vineyards, and who have labor that they can give. And they're thinking, man, you're really desperate, which means I can set myself up for the future. You're really desperate, which means you might not have sold me that field 2 years ago, but today, you'll sell it to me. And so they're looking at people that are in danger, that are desperate, and they're exploiting them for their own gains. Which, let's think about that in the modern day. Would you say that American politicians are in it for the people of America or for themselves? On the large.
For themselves.
Every politician, most politicians, they're going to have a bunch of people paying them money to make certain laws. They're not doing it because they care about the people they're ruling. They're doing it for their own sake. And that's not different today than it was long ago. These rich people have the opportunity to be taking care of others, and instead they're exploiting them. And in your life, when you are put into a position where you have leverage over someone else, are you going to act out of love for them, or are you going to be like the rich people in Nehemiah 5, and then you're going to serve your own needs at their expense? So then Nehemiah, he actually starts talking to them about it. And so Nehemiah verse 6, Nehemiah says, "I was very angry when I heard their outcry and these words." And I'm going to stop there for a second. So in our modern day, in the church, is it a good thing or a bad thing to get angry? What do you hear? Is it a good thing or a bad thing to get angry? Yes.
Bad.
It's a bad thing. If you have an outburst and you break out and you scream at someone, that's on the large just automatically people are going to be confronting you about that. You need to be more patient. You need to be more kind. So I'm going to read you a verse in the New Testament. It's John chapter 2, verses 13 to 16. And this is about Jesus. So if you think that Jesus is sinning, there's a problem. But I'm going to read this. "The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers were sitting there." Which, this is a system of oppression where these people in Jerusalem, these were called the Bazaars of Annas, and they were exploiting the people going to the temple to give their sacrifices, and they were charging them these massive upcharges on sacrifices and animals that would have been worth far less anywhere else, and just out of necessity, the people were having to pay anyways. So Jesus goes into the temple, and he sees all of these people using his temple to exploit his people, and this is his response. "And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, 'Take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade.'" Elsewhere, he says, "You have taken my father's house and made it a den of robbers." So Jesus, that's a little bit weird language to kind of like imagine what he just did. But he made a whip. And then he went into the temple, which was a very large building. Like, imagine the nearest mall. And imagine one man making a whip and forcing every single business person in that mall out into the parking lot. So I want you to imagine the amount of violence and rage that that would require, the amount of outright insanity that that would require to be able to successfully do that without just getting dogpiled by three police officers and nailed. Like, Jesus was going absolutely ham. Like, imagine for a moment our picture of Jesus, this dude with long hair and a beard, smiling and walking by and never ever raising his voice. That is not the picture of Jesus that the Bible paints at all. And yet, if Jesus were to do something like this in the modern day, he would walk out afterward to a group of 20 elders, super upset with him, talking about how you can't get angry like that. There is a demon in you, man. That was wrong. Do you see the problem? And the issue is that in our modern day and in the American church right now, we do not have an appreciation for the proper place of anger. So anger is not wrong. God gets angry all over the Bible. Jesus, who is our example of a Christian life, got very angry and very violent. So to say that anger is always wrong is actually just an incorrect understanding. So there are times where it is actually the right thing to be angry, and if you're not angry, there's a problem. So the difference is this. Are you angry because you didn't get what you wanted? Or are you angry because God's angry? Because for Jesus, he was angry because the center of God's worship, the people who were coming to worship God, were being exploited. And so are you angry about the things that God gets angry about? Or are you angry because you didn't get there first? Like, is Nehemiah angry because of the oppression of the Jews? Or is Nehemiah angry because he's upset that he wasn't able to come in earlier to get those vineyards and fields and money? He wanted the slaves. No. Nehemiah was angry for the right reasons. And as Christians, we aren't these, you know, subdued, always happy, always go lucky, never raising our voices, never bold, never powerful. We aren't these sheep that just do nothing. As a Christian, you are supposed to be courageous. And we talked about this earlier on in Nehemiah. As a Christian, you are supposed to be courageous. You are supposed to be understanding of when it's time to, you know, burst. So when I heard their cry and these words, I took counsel with myself. So he's thinking about it. He's not just in his anger going out and killing someone. So that's also important. Even when you're angry, it doesn't mean that you just lash out. But I brought charges against the nobles and the officials. So again, Nehemiah is the governor here. He's in charge. So he takes counsel with himself because it is his decision. And then he goes to the nobles and officials and he said, "You are exacting interest, each from his brother. And I held a great assembly against them and said to them, 'We, as far as we are able, have brought back our Jewish brothers who have been sold to the nations, but you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us.'" So what Nehemiah is saying is, where's Nehemiah from again? Is he from Jerusalem? No, he's not. Where's he from? He's from Babylon. He's from Persia, right? And he was sent out. And he brought with him all of, a bunch of the exiles that were in that area came with Nehemiah to Jerusalem. Yes.
Is he a Jew?
He is. Nehemiah is a Jew. Yes. So Nehemiah was actually one of the exiles that came back. So Nehemiah is saying, I came out here, I left everything I had, and I brought with me all of these exiles that were parts of the other nations. I bring them back to Jerusalem. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm sacrificing for these people. And you, who were here from the beginning, you, fellow Jews, are exploiting people instead. And have you ever met someone who's like getting on you for doing something, and you're like, but you do the same thing? You know, situations like that, it's like, hey, don't yell at your brother. And then you're like, well, you yell at my brother all the time. And Nehemiah is saying, guys, what are you doing? And they were silent and could not find a word to say. They had no ability to say, well, Nehemiah, you do the same thing. They couldn't find a single area in Nehemiah's life where that was the same issue. And they knew that they were wrong. So I said, the thing that you are doing is not good. Ought you not to walk in the fear of God to prevent the taunts of Ought you not to walk in the fear of our God to prevent the taunts of the nations, our enemies? So think about this. He just talked about, Nehemiah is talking to these rich people and he's saying, don't you realize that people are watching? Because we're Christians, right? Christians, little Christs. So what we do, who gets credit for that? When we do stuff that we're not supposed to do, when we're acting the way we shouldn't be acting, who gets credit for that? Who do we represent? God. That's right. Romans 2 verses 23 and 24, Paul says, you who boast in the law dishonor God by breaking the law, for it is written, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. And Nehemiah is saying, guys, what are you doing? You're oppressing your neighbors, you're oppressing your brothers, you're oppressing the other Jews, and the other nations are watching you. What do you think that makes God look like? But contrary to that, Jesus says in John 13:35, by this all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. And so, Nehemiah says, return to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive orchards, and their houses, and the percentage of money, grain, wine, and oil that you have been exacting from them. So Nehemiah says, all that stuff that you took from them, all that stuff that you used for your own advantage to exploit them, give it back. And then they said, we will restore these and require nothing from them. We will do as you say. And then Nehemiah, he doesn't actually trust them. He says, and I called the priests and made them swear to do as they had promised. So even though they gave Nehemiah their word, it wasn't enough for him. He brought the priests in. He got it in writing, as you might say. And so I shook out the fold of my garment and said, so may God shake out every man from his house and from his labor who does not keep this promise. So may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the assembly said, amen. And they praised the Lord, and the people did as they had promised. So Nehemiah makes them sign on the dotted line, so to speak. And then he curses them. And he says, if you don't do this, may God take everything you have from you. May God curse you. So he's kind of like laying it on. But then we get to the third thing. So the second thing was the restitution from the rich. And now we get to the last point, the righteousness. Of Nehemiah. So we see that there are two options. It's not just that every single person who has influence, every single person who is in a leadership position, it's not that every single person like that is going to be evil. It's not like everyone who does that is an oppressor. There are people that they are in leadership, that they are given influence, that they are given power, and they don't misuse it. And it's people who are motivated properly. Because now Nehemiah, the book of Nehemiah, it's kind of like Nehemiah's report to God, where it's as though if you were journaling and you were like, Lord, and then writing what you did that day. Like Nehemiah is essentially Nehemiah's journal to God. And so now Nehemiah talks to God about this situation. And he says, moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allowance of the governor. The former governors who were before me laid heavy burdens on the people and took from them their daily ration, 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants lorded it over the people, but I did not do so because of the fear of God. I also persevered in the work on this wall, and we acquired no land, and my servants were gathered there for the work. Moreover, there were at my table 150 men, Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now what was prepared at my expense for each day was one ox and six choice sheep and birds, and every 10 days all kinds of wine in abundance. Yet for all this I did not demand the food allowance of the governor, because the service was too heavy on this people. Remember for my good, O my God, all that I have done for this people. So we have Nehemiah in a completely different set of actions than the rich people in this story. Nehemiah is the governor. And when he talks about the food allowance, that's not a food allowance from, you know, the king of Babylon. That's a food allowance from the people. In other words, Nehemiah is saying, I had a right to tax the people in my leadership. And as the governor, he did have the right to tax them. The Bible establishes elsewhere the government has the right to tax people. That's true. And so Nehemiah, who had the right to tax people, it says that he did not. And even more than just not taxing them, in verse 17, he says that at my table were 150 men, Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. So not only is Nehemiah not taxing people in the area, he's actually hosting them. He's feeding 150 people regularly in a famine, by the way. And as people are coming from other nations, Jews that are coming from around to come and join the work of the Jerusalem, he's feeding them too. And he says again that it was not from the food allowance. So he's not taxing people to be able to do that. He's taking from his own money. In verse 18, he says, now it was prepared at my expense for each day was one ox and six choice sheep and birds, and every 10 days, all kinds of wine in abundance. So Nehemiah, at his own expense, is taking care of the people that are in his charge. Is Nehemiah doing this for himself? Is Nehemiah profiting and getting rich off of the situation? No. Nehemiah is actually, you know, he's losing money. And I want to read you guys a verse from the New Testament. Because again, for us, it's hard to identify with some old Jew who is the governor of an area. Like, none of us are government leaders. But every single one of us has a situation where we're going to be in a group project or in a church, we're going to have leadership over someone else. And what are you going to do with it? In 1 Peter 5, 2 through 3, Peter says, shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you. Not for shameful gain, but eagerly. Not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. Which, that's a very similar phrase to what Nehemiah said in verse 15. Verse 15. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. Even their servants lorded it over the people, but I did not do so. So Nehemiah is very similar to what Peter is saying, and Peter may very well have had in mind Nehemiah in this chapter. Because what Peter lays out is extremely similar to what Nehemiah says. And I mean, he's also referring to Jesus, who talks about, do not lord it over people as the Gentiles do. But Nehemiah, man, and when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. So Peter says, lead people carefully. Why? Because God's coming back. And one of the things that should scare you is that when you are in a situation where you have influence over someone else, if you abuse that, the person that you answer to is God. In James 3:1, he says, not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. When you see people in government positions, when you look at pastors, when you look at anyone who has authority over someone else, you should be praying for them, for their sake. Because if they are acting corruptly and if they're doing the wrong thing, there are major consequences for that. And one of the ways that you can apply this, even if you're not specifically in a position of leadership, you should pray for the people that are. Because they are in an extremely dangerous position if they don't act the way that they're supposed to. Pray for your parents. Did you know that your parents are going to get judged for how they raise you? So if you love your parents and you care about them, pray for them. Pray that they would do a good job. Pray that they would grow. Pray that they would care for you the way that they're supposed to. And one day when you're a parent, take that seriously. So I want to ask you guys a question. Let's say you have a sponge. If you squeeze the sponge and a bunch of black goop comes out of that sponge, why did a bunch of black goop come out of the sponge?
Because there was black goop in it.
Yeah. Some people will say that the black goop came out because you squeezed it. But I would say the black goop came out because there was black goop in it. And so in our lives, you can be tested by difficult circumstances. There are times when people are put into a hard spot and they break and they do everything that they're not supposed to do. But there are other times when people are put into a, quote, good spot and they're given power and influence and what comes out is a bunch of black goop. And so for us, we should be working on our hearts. Because Nehemiah, he was a good leader because he was motivated by love for God and love for people. And that's the same thing that motivated him in chapter 1 when he was praying and mourning over Jerusalem and then he went to the king and asked that he might go rebuild the walls. Nehemiah didn't start with a bunch of power over a bunch of people. He started with a cup in his hand. And when he was given a bunch of power over a bunch of people, he didn't get corrupted by it, but what was already in his heart came out. And so, remember that. A litmus test does not change the solution. A litmus test tells you what's already in it. And so for you guys, you should be preparing your hearts. You should be training yourself to love people. And then if you're put into a situation of leadership, what's going to come out is what's already in you. So with that, I'm going to bow my head. We can pray it out, and then we'll have some small groups. Lord, thank you that you give us good examples. Thank you that you show us stories like Nehemiah, where we have good examples and bad examples put right next to each other. I pray that you would help us to care about people, that you would help us to love each other and to love the people around us and to love our leaders and to love the people that we have leadership over. I pray that you would help us to recognize that there is a high price to leadership, that there is a risk associated with leadership. And I pray that you would help us to love each other and love other people so that when we are put into a position of leadership or leverage, that we won't exploit someone else for our own sake, but that instead, Lord, that we would love them and take care of them. Lord, we pray these things in the name of our King Jesus Christ. Amen.